From one islander to another, Isle of Wight Radio proudly presents John Hannam Meets.
My guest today is Mike Stirling, currently playing Perron in Evita, and it's coming to Southsea from November the 13th to the 17th. So have you enjoyed the tour so far?
Oh, John, it's been delightful. It really has. We've been some fantastic theatres, got some great audiences. And it's wonderful touring, actually, because knowing a lot of people like yourself, and you go to these places and they say, you're coming down to Southsea, or you're coming down to Bournemouth. We'll sort you out. Don't be booking any digs and things like that. So I've actually, as well as had a great time with the show, I've reconnected, with a lot of people, which is often very difficult when you're touring in this business. You move around a lot, and of course it's 8 shows a week because you have a day off and a travel day, so you don't get a chance to see many people. But that it's been delightful, and the company's great to work with. It's a lovely journey.
Early on, you were inspired by some great Welsh voices, weren't you, really? Ryan Davies, Alan Davies.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Ryan Davies, were born in the same place in Glenammon, so we're born in the same village, and in this small little hospital down the way, just at the bottom of the hill. But yeah, I mean, Ryan Davies was an incredible performer. His sort of demographic, really, of audience would be from my age, when I first discovered him, 4 years old or something. So it's from 4 to 94. Certain demographic was right for him. He covered the whole thing and just was probably one of the most talented people I'd ever come across. And sadly lost too early. He was 40 when he left us. But Alan Davies, a wonderful singer. Till today, we're great friends. And I started having coaching with him when I was about 15. So I thank him really for that, as you say, for having the foundation of the voice, both speech-wise and singing. He gave me a very good foundation to... And fortunately, it's sort of proved to have longevity, which is lovely.
You were singing in the Welsh clubs when you were about 14, weren't you?
Yes, I did. I started semi-professionally at 14. I was still at school. So
was that tough?
It was. I mean, it's kind of exciting because it was the mid-80s, so 1984, 85. And it was quite an exciting time because even various clubs... They used to book some quite big acts. So I actually got to work with quite a lot of the big acts, like the Drifters and all these sort of, they would book these people in the club. It was fantastic. Oh, yes, tomorrow night, yeah, we've got the Drifters. They're on with you. You've got a couple of spots either side of them. Yeah, it was tough. If you survived, and that being the operative word, you went to some clubs, they were like, come on, entertain us. It's like, sit with folded arms, come on, see what you got. It was like a test.
Yes.
Almost. So a bit like an audition. So except it lasts about an hour and a half. So if you got through that, you'd kind of earned your stripes a bit, really. And if you got rebooked at that particular club, then you're all right.
Were the faggots and peas served in your clubs or not?
Oh, yeah, chicken in the basket.
And all that stuff.
Yeah, all that sort of stuff.
I know you sang in your parents' hotel from earlier than that, didn't you?
Yes, I was 7, but the year Elvis died. And there was a reception put on for my elder sister's wedding, and we had a guy on the guitar entertaining and singing. And he said, any requests? And I said, well... And I was a big Elvis admirer. He was a big influence on me, even that young. And I said, it's got to be something by the King, in my opinion, because we've just lost him. And he looks over and he said, where did that voice come from? He said, well, it's me. And I got a little 7-year-old kid. And he said, come over here. This is bizarre. So he said, so what song is it? I said, oh, it's Now or Never, Elvis Presley. He said, God, you must know this song then. And I named a few other tracks. I said, but that's the one I'd like you to do. He said, look, I can play it, but it's not, I don't do Elvis. I can't do Elvis. I do rock and roll, I'll do a bit of Stones, Rolling Stones. He said, do you like the Rolling Stones? Or you do a bit of Herman's Hermits, Jeremy the Pacemakers kind of thing. But he said, no, I can't. I don't do Elvis. I don't attempt that. He said, so you do it. So I was seven. I got up and sang It's No One Ever. And then ever since then, it was kind of set in stone. When I got in from school, they'd pull me into the bar. And that was my extracurricular activity, I suppose. Never went to scouts or things like that. You know, I tried that, but it didn't really work. So that was my extracurricular activity, when I sing at the pub and actually earn quite well.
Mm.
I mean, this guy said, no, then, stop singing for nothing. He said, you don't sing for nothing. Come on, boys, stop being so tight. Put it on your pocket. Give it. This boy's been singing all afternoon, you know. So, yeah, I remember in like late 70s, early 80s, tipping up a hat under my bed. I was like 35 quid, you know, inside this. I mean, in those days, that was more than a week's wages for some people.
Yeah.
So my parents sent me all this money. I was buying presents for people. I said, where have you got this money from? You know, immediately thought, this is a bit dodgy. I said, boys in the bar. I said, I was singing, and they all did a whip round. And that's a... So it started very young, really. Because I suppose once you get paid for doing something, so you class as a pro, aren't you?
Yes.
Well, the act of it is that. So, yeah, so I've always sang from that age. And that was the catalyst, really, of going on to the clubs, as you say, the testing ground.
Yes. Yeah. 87 with New Faces, that was a key part of your early life.
Yeah,
wasn't
that, that sort of...
Because you won it, didn't you?
I won the out of the musical acts, because it was the first to fourth position, right? And there was in that final, there was a guy called, I think, Jimmy Tamley, who's a ventriloquist.
Oh, I know him well.
And yeah, you know Jimmy?
Oh, yeah. Errol, he had a black doll, didn't he, called Errol? Do you remember
Errol,
that?
And he had Knuckles. Knuckles.
Yeah, yeah, that's it. Yeah. Yeah.
So Knuckles, and he won it. And then there was Joe Pasquale.
Yes.
Came second. Then there was I think it was a Brothers Demented or something, the ones with the baskets on their head, and then me. So obviously on that, everyone gone for comedy, but I was, you know, very pleased as one of the winners. And we did a winners tour. I actually did a winners the following year. We did a New Faces winners tour. And they were the Granada, the bingo halls.
Oh, yes.
You remember?
Yeah.
Of course, which used to be theatres, really. Theatres and palais, you know, the old local palais and things like that, where it was everybody who was anybody sang at and performed at, big names. And then, of course, from the bingo halls, my friend down in Bournemouth, Ian Sopp, was our tour manager, and I met him. And it was his sort of advice to them. He said, look, this will work. It'd be great. It was kind of the X Factor of its day, except it didn't have the machine that's, of course, behind it.
Who was the
now.
Ogre on your show then? Who was the...
Oh, Nina Miskov.
Oh, right,
yeah,
yes.
She was the one.
Yes.
And, yeah, she was the one that... you didn't have... Yeah, you had, in the older days, what was it?
Tony Hatch.
Tony Hatch, that's
yeah,
right.
And yeah.
Yeah, but Nina was... Yeah, Nina could be quite... she was quite nice to me, actually. Although she did... I think the worst thing she said about me, she said, well, I could live without the man from CNA, look, but if he needs any help with his dressing... I mean, literally, I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified.
But then sort of West End offers came, didn't they?
Well, yeah, I started touring. I had my own musicians, and we started touring various theatres, some of the big venues, and some of the big clubs as well. It was still very much... good grounding place to work, and we got some fantastic work. It's a venue, you know, people used to really frequent those big clubs. Some of these big clubs could seat 2,000 people, so it's like doing a theatre in a big stage. But so I was very happy doing that, did very well, but I just sensed something wasn't quite right. I mean, I enjoyed it, but I felt there's something missing, and I was sort of on some sort of quest, and then I went to see Les Miserables when I was 18, and that's, I went, now we're talking. That is, I didn't know what it was I wanted to do, but I knew something was missing. But when I saw that, that's what sparked it all off, really.
You ended up playing Marius, didn't you?
Yeah, well, 3 years later, yeah. I was in that very production I saw in the West End in London. But I understudied Enjolras, but consequently did a lot of performances as Enjolras. 10 months, for over 10 months, and 10 months later, yeah, I went on to play Marius in the new Manchester production, and we were there for 18 months.
John Hannam, host of British Radio's longest-running non-stop chat show, This Is Your Life.
A thousand times you played Phantom, at least.
Yeah, quite a few. People said, what was it like playing the Phantom for the first time? I mean, was it terrifying? Was it, you know? I said, well, it was a bit unconventional, the way when I played my first Phantom. I said, oh, I'm intrigued, what do you mean? I said, well, I was actually playing Raoul in Manchester, down the road, because I moved from the Palace Theatre. A few months later, I moved down the road to do the other Jubilee of Raoul. So for the new Manchester production, we have 2 years. Anyway, on the second year, they said, look, we'd like you to look at the Phantom score. We'll want to see where we can go with this. I know you're doing Raoul, but you should... Andrew says, and a few people have said, no, there's something about his voice is right for this. He's a bit young yet, but let's see if we can kind of nurture it. Let's see if we can kind of build it in. I knew the score, and I think I'd teched the first act. That's it, because I came in. I thought, I'll come in, just in case. You never know, because I'm looking at this now. So I had no mask, I had no pieces, I had no prosthetics. I had no costume made for me yet. But I thought, no, if I'm going to learn the score, I'm going to learn it to the sense that there may be a time I'm thrown on. Well, there was a knock at the door one day. Company manager comes in and said, Mike, I've got a question for you. I said, what's that? He said, can you do the Phantom today? And very swiftly left the room. I went, Tony, come back in. We actually caught up with Tony recently down in Bromley. It was fantastic, you know, 25 years later. Anyway, yeah. So Tony, and we talked about this, and he said, I remember your face. So it was a picture. I said, you serious? He said, yeah. He said, I am serious. He said, the Phantom was away on holiday, so the walking cover had come in, got everything ready, and it's just suddenly his voice just wasn't working. Or he said, it's cracking all over the place. He said, he can't... I said, I guess rather than send people home, we've got to do it. He said, but I said, one thing, Tony, I haven't teched anything in Act Two, anything. And it's a dangerous stuff. The trapdoors, the mausoleum, where you're on the travelator coming out from the cross, firing the fireballs, disappearing, the big magic trick, for Paul Daniels' magic trick at the end, yeah. when the illusion, when he disappears. And all that is very intricate. So he said, I said, but let's not think about that now. Let's just do Act One and we'll do that in the interval. And that's literally, I mean, you couldn't do that now.
No.
You couldn't do it with health and safety and whatever, insurance or whatever. But so I did Act One. And people were saying, what do you mean Mike's doing Phantom? Are you crazy? Some people had got the idea of the news that I'd been looking up the role and therefore was like kind of like second cover, but I was still doing Raoul. And I went on, and and in the interval, I tacked Act Two.
Sure.
And I just went with it. And it was just, I could say, I feel it, you know, now I can still remember that feeling of being terrified, but, you know, fueled by excitement.
Yeah.
Terrified excitement. I thought, well, no, listen, I'm not packing parachutes. No one's going to die. You know, I'm going to go on and do this. So the excitement around the theatre was just on another level. And it was like the wings of people when I was doing the various scenes and things with Christine. I mean, the wings were full of the cast, just all there. Come on, yes, yes. He's bloody doing it. He's doing it, you know. So that was the first time ever. And that was 20 minutes notice before the curtain went up. So, you know. Lots of time to make up your mind.
Looking back on your career, you've worked in the same shows as Clapton, Bassi and Manilow. Yeah. That's been wonderful, really.
Oh, it was actually terrific. And I remember walking in to the Albert Hall. And you know there, it's like a rabbit warren, isn't it? Of tunnels and hallways and a series of dressing rooms. And there's quite a lot of dressing rooms. But on a show like the Royal Gala, the Prince's Trust, there's... The whole world and his wife is normally on these things. And that in particular, you had on that bill, you had Eric Clapton, Barry Manilow, Shirley Bassey. You had Joanna Lumley and Sir David Frost, the late Sir David Frost, doing the comparing, doing all the links. An incredible array of people. So I get backstage and I've got my tails and my suits and everything on my shoulder. Walk in, saw the dressing room. Oh, and I saw my name, Mike Sterling, and it's... I just, you zone in on that. You know, you don't see the other people there. You just, your eyesight, when you're going to find your dressing room, is, you know, get ready. It's like, yeah, that's me. And you go in. So I went in and I looked around. This is quite a big room and there's other people in there. So I thought, oh, I don't know, maybe they made a mistake, you know. And I went, am I in here? He said, and a voice from behind, like a, you know, he's reading newspaper like this. I think we all are. And as it came to, it was Eric Clapton. You know, just with his reading glasses on, reading that. Yeah, do you want a cup of tea? And it was amazing. He said, yeah, come in. Yeah, just, I said, and I'm standing there, Eric Clapton sitting there, to reading his paper, getting out my makeup and I'm getting up my bits and, you know, and getting my suit sorted out. And I just keep glancing over. As I suppose, and people say about being starstruck, that was the first, like, moment of that. I was just in awe, really. I thought, I'm not just watching this guy. I'm just to watch him live would be great, which I'd never done to this point, but I'm sharing a dressing room with him. And then in walks Stephen Fry. And then in walks Richard Wilson. I do not believe it, you know, I said. So, and then in walks Nigel Hawthorne. And all these legends of screen and the stage and music. And then in walks Cannon and Ball. You know, so it was, I remember us all sitting around, like some great photos actually of that. And they were all sitting around just chatting about each other's life. It was a bit like a support group. It was, yeah. And then going out into the audience, I'm sitting, because I'm on last, because I'm doing Sullivan's Lost Chord with a massive choir of like 400 or 500 people. And actually, unbeknownst to me, I'd sort of come across this guy quite a few times in doing different concerts, because he used to do work with the Doyle Carr. And in the voices behind me was the one and only Alfie Bow. That was, and it's going back to, what was it, 1996, wow. Something like that. And yeah, Alfie was in the back. I remember going to the bar after, and Shirley Bassey was in there, and we were all singing at the piano. My friend Jeff Fields on the piano. I mean, he's never the piano if he's in a piano. If the lid is up and he's playing. And it was Julie McGinnis Johnson, the opera singer, and Alfie and myself all singing like Summertime, you know. It was just electric. And then the thing that really got me, I was sitting in the audience, like I say, waiting for my point, and everything was always rehearsed in situ. So from the point of the first song, not get all the bits that are everyone's involved in and then let them go. They did it as if in real time, through the right path. So I'm listening to all these acts coming out, and then out comes Clapton, does Alberta on the washboard and all that kind of unplugged stuff. Fantastic. And then I'm sitting there, and this lady was on the stage with like a scarf and a coat and, you know, a big coat and a scarf, but proper like a, you know, like a scarf you see, a normal scarf,
yeah,
you know, the bit where the glasses, right? It's something like sunglasses. And I was about to say, sorry, love, have you lost your way? Are you okay? You all right? And there was a gesture like that, like with the hand, you know, you know. So, excuse me, are you all right? You're on the stage at the Albert Hall. And because it just looked like someone had lost, yeah, their way off the street, right? So then she's tapping the mic, you know, tapping the mic. Then the shades came off, and then this voice. And she's literally taking the coats off of their outdoor clothes as she's starting the song. It's like, there's no time for us. We've all decided for us. It's Shirley Bassey. I can't believe this. And it's just like, taking off these bits of clothing and popping them down, and then suddenly, and Shirley is revealed. I mean, that style, that is,
oh yes,
yeah. I mean, so, and then Barry Manilow comes on, does his one voice and memory, and I remember I followed him actually up to do this big finale, and he's there playing, I think, his memory, because he likes the Lloyd Webber stuff, and he recorded that, so he's playing, I think, his memory from Cats or something, and then going into Even Now. And I remember seeing his profile, just looking out, and I went, oh my God. I'm peering through the curtains there, and Manilow is on the piano. And I got, I'm going to go out after him. This is not right, somehow, you know? But it was just that was probably the biggest bill ever I've been involved in, you know?
You've had an amazing career, because you sang Got to Pick a Pocket or Two in China, didn't you?
I did.
Yeah.
I did. Fagin is a very interesting role. And I just tried to... I know there's been various people have played it and played it various different ways and all great in their respective journeys. But I wanted to kind of... I played him quite dark. I played him real. But I didn't play, you know, for the laughs. And I just thought, I got to take this... Because he's quite a dark old character. Mm-hmm. But this is what he is. Mm-hmm. He just knows how to survive. He knows how to get through. And he knows how to teach children to work for him, you know, on a, picking his pockets of two, and, yeah, as you say. That business, the business involved as an actor and props and clothing, especially the song that really, you know, is the reviewing the situation. Mm. That's the one that really kind of, your journey with that and your thought process with that to, for it to be successful. You've taken the coat on and off, doing all that sort of business. But also the darker scenes in The Three Cripples with Nancy and Bill Sykes was electric. It was a lovely thing to do. And it's never been done in China before. So it was like the Chinese premiere.
Wow.
And it was 120-piece orchestra. It was just an international cast. And about 250 children. It was just unbelievable, you know.
Early on, you did acting. Hello, hello. You did the chief, Surgical Spirit.
Yeah, that was when I moved to London, sort of late 80s, and I had an agency in London, International Artists, which now these days is some of the people that you know that have been involved with International Artists in the early days is now part of the Kudos. The Kudos Empire.
Nick Thomas.
Yes, Nick Thomas, John Conway, and all that.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it was Nick Thomas now. But I was part of all that early light entertainment stuff, and they would put me on supporting Jim Davidson. I'd be supporting Bobby Davro. Yeah, and met some amazing Bruce Forsyth and lots of the incredible. I mean, and Sir Bruce was. God bless him, he was just, and Bob Monkhouse. I mean, these are masters. And here I am, boy from Wales, working with these people. And Surgical Spirit was that. I signed with an agency and said, oh, Mike, and he's a Welsh guy. Agent said, I'd like you to come down. And he said, we've got a job for you. I said, what's that, Surgical Spirit? I said, okay, what have we got to do? He said, just turn up and then just do whatever. So it was just like, you got this line, that line, nothing, you know, major, but I was like 19 or something. And then Hello, Hello, and I'd be an Italian soldier with like Gavin Richards, who played Bertarelli. So we were these three most bravest troops. And I'm working with Gordon Kaye.
Oh, yeah.
Gordon was a delightful man.
Yeah, I'm actually. Sure. Well, I met him once, yeah.
He was great. And he said, come up to the bar, BBC bar. You know, we went to BBC Bar and we'd sit and talk for hours. He was delightful. And that's just I was about 3 or 4 days I worked on there, nearly a week. But he was always, you know, I didn't see him much after until after he had that accident. You remember when half a tree came through his window? I mean, it really damaged his brain and everything. Mm. But I remember going to an opening night of Heaven's Up with my then drama coach, David Kelsey. The late David Kelsey was, again, phenomenal actor, great director. And I said, oh, just a minute. I said, Gordon's here. I said, I'm going to go say hello to Gordon. And of course, because of the damage, he didn't remember everybody. Because he was having to reintroduce a lot of things, different parts of the, some of the brain had been taken away, I suppose, with this awful accident. But he stood there and he went, I know you. Where do I know? And I went, BBC Bar. You know, I said it was about 4 or 5 years prior, I think, something like that. BBC Bar, Gin and Tonic. Okay. He said, I think money comes into it somewhere. Money. And he'd remember, you mean, Sterling. And he went, I said, I'm Mike.
Very clever.
I remember saying to myself, when I met you, I don't remember this guy's name if I ever forget it. Money. And then that's what that was. So that was delightful. See, but after then, I never saw Gordon again, but he was wonderful. He was wonderful. And Gavin Richards and Arthur Bostrom. Just class. Just class.
Good morning, everybody, and welcome to John Hannam Moots.
I used to love Summertime Special. You did one of those, didn't
yeah,
you?
With Bobby Davro.
Yeah, I love Bobby Davro.
When it was like things like, remember the Mac Band?
Yes.
Roses Are Red. I remember they were on the charts at the time. That song was in the charts. And I'd got the Now Music thing. I'd only just started. Like it's now, I think it's now something like 1,000 now or something, isn't it?
Yeah, something like
yeah.
that.
then it's like Now 3, I think it was, or something. And I remember I used to listen to this song. The next thing, I'm standing on the same stage as them playing this song, and then Bobby Davro comes on, does his bit, introduces me. You've got a host of people on that show. I mean, so many. Variety in those days, I mean, you literally, the bill was ridiculous, wasn't it? Mm. I mean, you would, everybody that was active at that time, and even people being reintroduced, you used to have, and then that Sunday night London Palladiums, you'd suddenly, Bob Roy Orbison would pop up, hadn't he? I mean, it was just glorious, really.
So you're playing Perron in Evita. You've got a matinee in a minute, haven't you?
I have. Yeah. A matinee in a minute. I could do a little vocal warm-up. They let me out of the physical one today, so we can have a good chat, and I'll do my vocal warm-up in probably about 10 minutes.
Okay.
And then it's time to get a little snack before we get to the half-hour call, yeah.
And it's just a show, it's a must-see show, Evita, isn't it? Any time, really.
Yeah, I mean, it's in its 40th. We're doing its 40th anniversary tour with this, which, so I think you can safely say it works. People obviously love it, and the audiences have been tremendous in both numbers and in the way they've received the show. It is a wonderful story, you know, and even some people are a bit sceptical about the Peronism and the, you know, because he was a fascist dictator. He knew what he wanted, he got what he wanted, and so was Ava, which is why there was such a formidable team, really. And to play that, but with Lucy and I, you know, you see the human side. Because I have most of the interaction on scenes with her, obviously, as my girlfriend initially, and then my wife, after she'd got me out of prison and got me elected, you know, got rallied the people together. And then, because he was actually president 3 times of Argentina, and twice he had to go into exile, because they were after, you know, they were after his blood. But what a brave guy. So, especially the final scene, it's about two people that love each other incredibly, and are losing, you know, they're losing each other. I mean, she's dying, of course, so she's losing her life and losing him, and he's losing the love of his life. There's nothing more than that. It's as simple and down to basics as that, and it's a very powerful scene.
I know I should be shedding the odd tear in Sousy when I come to see it.
Oh, it is one. Well, I mean, I do frequently. It's, you can't help but be moved by it, and when I'm taking that journey, I try and attempt to make it as truthful as I can. And he has to observe everything. That's the one thing about Perón in this, in Evita. He observes everything because he's the stage manager. He's the stage manager behind all that stuff, all the Casa Rosada balcony, and when she spoke to the people. And of course, in this show, Don't Cry For Me, Argentina, he stage managed the whole thing. He was clever, even down to his benefit concert when he's tonight I'm proud to be the great people's spokesman, etc., etc. And he sets up the majors there as if the people should run their affairs on their own. Thank you very much. A lot of use you are. But I'm here for the people. I mean, he talks, and then he's lounge lizard. Then he drops his hat, and then he's Mr. Lounge Lizard, gets the glass of wine, off he goes, meet the women, and that's where he meets Ava. And, you know, of course, the rest is history, as we say.
Mike Sterling, thanks for your time. You've got to go and do your vocal warm-up in a couple of minutes.
So. Absolutely. No, this is all good stuff. And John, it's lovely to chat to you. It really is.
Thank you very much, and wish your career continued success.
Thank you, John. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to John Hannam Meets, courtesy of Isle of Wight Radio. Don't forget to look at my website, johnhannam.com, for news of more interviews and how you might purchase my books. Thanks for listening. Bye-bye for now.